heavy metal, invented in Birmingham, refined in Newcastle. The story goes, if you believe such stories, that heavy metal was invented on Friday the 13th, February 1970, when Black Sabbath released their self-titled debut album. The opening track, also called Black Sabbath, begins with a thunderstorm, heavy rain, a tolling bell, and an ominous send-shiver-down-your-spine riff. A famous riff that slightly predates Sabbath and is known as the Devil's Interval. Diabolus in Musica, the Devil in Music. It was banned in churches in medieval times because it was believed that its playing invoked the appearance of the devil. The fascination with, and the threat of, the devil has always persisted in music, from folk songs of old, the forceful possession of jazz that lured the weak into clubs to unleash their most sinful, animalistic tendencies, and the blues. Satan's grip so powerful that Robert Johnson, one of the most influential blues musicians of all time, is said to have sold his soul to the devil at a crossroads in the Mississippi Delta in exchange for the ability to play like no other. The roots of heavy metal lie in the blues and its bastard offspring, rock and roll. And as the 60s progressed, more frenzied distortion from more frenzied guitarists created a brand new sound. Aggressive, ambivalent, and absolutely bodacious. The actual term heavy metal, as a description of a form of music, has long been attributed to Lester Bangs at Rolling Stone magazine. Although, as a phrase, it goes back a lot further than that, to 1962, when William Burroughs, in his novel The Soft Machine, introduced a character called Uranian Willie, the heavy metal kid. Now, one of the first bands to pick it up and run with it, Steppenwolf, in their 1968 hit Born to Be Wild, with the line, "I like smoke and lightning, heavy metal thunder." But back to Bangs, who popularised the phrase via extensive writing on Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath, explaining, as its detractors have always claimed, heavy metal rock is nothing more than a bunch of noise. It's a fast train to nowhere, which may be one reason why it seems to feel so good and makes so much sense to its fans. It's probably fair to say that in terms of heavy music, the UK dominated the 70s, just as domestic rock and roll had ruled the 60s. And while there were some great US bands, it was the British Big Three of Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple, and Black Sabbath that ruled the roost. In October 1970, Led Zeppelin issued their third album, creatively titled Led Zeppelin 3, to follow up Led Zeppelin 2, and of course, Led Zeppelin. But first, off the mark was Deep Purple, whose Shades of Deep Purple album appeared in 1968. Now, though at that time, they still hadn't quite traded flower power for power chords, they were still in their flares and their hippie shirts, wearing the odd bead around their neck and a hat with a flower or a feather in it. But those of us who were listening to it and loving it could feel the change was coming. A mere 7 months after Black Sabbath's self-titled debut, Sabbath unveiled their second album, Paranoid. And this was the band that first captured the attention of Venom's Tony Abaddon Bray.
When I first heard Black Sabbath, I just thought it was the darkest, meanest thing you could hear.
I used to babysit for a cousin of mine, a couple of different kids, and one of their dads in particular was into Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, Free, some of the American bands like Creedence Clearwater and Grateful Dead and this sort of thing. And he said I could play his records when he went out, and every time I went back I would go back to South Bloody Sabbath and some of the Deep Purple stuff, but it was Sabbath that really got me into listen to this sort of stuff.
The 70s were a great time to be a rock fan. By the middle of the decade, UFO had let go of their space rock obsession. Judas Priest had worked their Queen pretensions out of their system. And Uriah Heep had shrugged off the Deep Purple clones tag. Thin Lizzy's Jailbreak album and a top 10 single, The Boys Are Back in Town, nudged the band back into the limelight once more. Life couldn't really get any better than this, until Steve Jones dropped the F-bomb on Bill Grundy's Today TV show and the Sex Pistols became an overnight sensation. The emergence of punk towards the end of 76, together with the rise of American New Wave, drove the rock and metal scene underground. British punk was overtly political. The Sex Pistols' debut, Anarchy in the UK, was a snarling, stick-your-middle-finger-up response to the powers that be. It was an anthem for the masses that felt bitter and angry, confused, frustrated and alienated in an economic situation where the vast majority of people, especially in the North, were on the bones of their backsides. As the rich kept getting richer and the poor remained poor, it always felt at that time, them and us, the powers that be controlling wealth and those of us who've never had it and it looked like we never would. It was very much about taking back control and doing it yourself. Atomcraft's Tony Demolition Man Dolan had just returned from spending much of his childhood in Canada, listening to bands like Kiss.
End of 77, coming into 78, I walked straight into a kind of music that I thought I had no idea what was going on because my hair was long. I was wearing flares and plaid jackets and had rock patches all over me. And all of a sudden I was confronted with punk rock, with the Sex Pistols and the Boomtown Rats and the Clash and the Stiff Little Fingers and Angelic Upstarts. And I was like, what is going on here? And I hadn't considered even being part of music until that point. But I saw that the country, we'd been in a bit of a downslide with the three-day week and power cuts and coming into the punk thing, there was garbage on the street. So there was actually anarchy in the UK from the youth. As with every generation, when you rebel, it comes out through the music, and punk rock was the result of that. I'd returned from a quite a comfortable environment into this anarchistic, screaming youth, and it just happened to be the right age for me.
Punk left its mark on a young Conrad Lant, who would go on to be the growling voice of Kronos, the singer and bassist of Venom.
That's when the punk thing exploded, like mid-70s. And that spoke to me so much because it wasn't just music. It was also a bit political. It was what was going on in the country. Jobs were hard to find. People thought the government weren't on their side. You know, all the sort of anarchy in the UK. And I used to say for years I probably got more of a life education from the likes of Johnny Rotten than I got off my own parents, for that matter, because my parents came from the 30s and 40s, whereas people who were even up to 10 years older than me, which were the guys in the Pistols and the Clash and the Damned, they had a massive influence on who I am today. You know, the whole thing about standing on your own 2 feet, don't be a sucker, go out there, do what you've got to do, and sticking to it, making sure that, you know, it's your idea and, you know, don't let anybody else fucking take advantage. That was, like, really massive in the punk era, you know. It was really influential.
Heavy metal and punk were two very different genres, often with two very different sets of fans who at times would clash. Punk was relatively short-lived, but its DIY, take-no-prisoners ethos would carry on in a late 70s boom of metal, which would go on to be known as the new wave of British heavy metal, which, like punk, came from the working class. A failing Labour government was replaced in May 1979 by a hard-nosed Conservative government led by Margaret Thatcher, the same month as the coining of the phrase the new wave of British heavy metal in Sounds music paper. And within months, unemployment began to spiral. In the northeast, a region famed for its heavy industry, the consequences were devastating, particularly with the mindset that young men would follow in their father's footsteps. They'd work in the same factory, shipyard or colliery, as Abaddon, Tony Bray, explains.
Railroads was a factory. There was a French guy called Rayroll, and he invested heavily in engineering in Hebburn. And pretty much anybody who lived in Hebburn who was of working age would work there. My dad, he was a multi-spindle driller, which was quite a specialised job. And I remember going to stand beside him once when I was working there, and he had this huge tub of these little whatchamacallits he'd been making. And he had this 6 spindles on this drill, and he would put this thing through its manufacture. and he threw it in this bin. And I'd be looking at this bin, there was thousands of the things in it. And he was on piecework. And I said, well, how does piecework work? And he said, well, you got paid for each part, and I have to make enough parts to build my money up during the day. I was right, so you've done thousands there. You must be loaded. He was saying, yeah, that's about 50 quid. And I was like, wow. And he's saying, that's good, but I've got to keep going to just get more in case there's nothing tomorrow. And I realised that was taking on responsibility for managing your own time as well as anything else, because quite often there would be dry periods, so you'd have to make enough money to cover you for the rest of the week. My dad came out at one point. I think his job, he was made redundant.
In hindsight, it wasn't that big a deal for them, but the feeling was that we panicked a little bit. It seemed like the feeling of the job for life had started to dwindle a bit.
If you have a job, it doesn't necessarily say that your brother's going to get a job, your uncle's going to get a job, and your sons are going to get jobs. But when I looked at the factory, that's exactly what did happen. In that one specific microcosm that I saw, which was thousands of people. I mean, Eric's dad worked there, my dad worked there, John Craig's dad worked there. All the people who we got to know as a clique of 16-year-olds, all our dads or uncles worked there. Got the best grade you could in art. Everything else was English and maths and whatever. We're all passes and we're all reasonable passes. But the only one that really stood out was art. And the person kind of fixated on that and said, you know, there's design work. I mean, I could still have worked in the factory with my dad in another part with the draftsman drawing up these drawings that my dad would make parts from. So there was still that tie-in. My head was drawing album covers and these fantastic worlds of Roger Dean and Yes songs and all this kind of stuff. My head was there. But my dad stood on that idea pretty quickly and just said, you listened to the, I think it was a lady, he listened to her for half an hour or so and he said, okay, thanks for talking, but he's going to come and work in the factory with me, he'll be fine. I got into it as an apprentice, sort of 16-year-old. You started in a training school as part of the factory. So to go into a factory and see all these huge machines that were spitting steel everywhere and all these noises and all these clanking and, you know, it was incredible. It was much, much different to being in education in school. If you think about it, I mean, you're talking about the early 70s and we all had long hair and we were all wearing bell-bottom jeans and we all had high boots on and all this kind of stuff and all Jack the Lads, really. They had a big meeting in this room and they said, you might think that it doesn't look cool to wear like a hat with a snood on the back and tuck your hair in. You might think it's cool to have your overalls unbuttoned and have your shirts hanging out and your hairy chest sticking out and all this kind of rubbish. You might think that looks cool, but you're going to wind up in a lot of problems. And there were shows, like a 16mm kind of thing, of people where you're concentrating on, there's a massive spindle turning on a lathe, and you're trying to get a cut down to like a thousandth of an inch. And you're concentrating on this, but you're not looking at this huge wheel that's spinning right beside you, and you've got your overalls hanging off. And if this gets snagged, you're going to get dragged into this machine. And they're trying to explain all this to us. And I had never, I guess none of us had really thought about it, that it was an issue, you know, because like I said, we just come out of school. And they handed around this piece of steel, the kind of finishing thing. And it was a steel bar and it had hair wrapped around it. And it turned out that it was a lad's human hair that he bent over to have a look at this machine. And the thing had grabbed his hair and pulled it off. And it had bits of scalp on it, actually had his skin, which was like leather. And I remember the guy saying, you can try pulling it off if you want. We've handed this around for 10 years now. It's pretty much welded on there. It won't come off. It was a right eye opener. I was like, I've never forgotten it. It just makes you think like, wow. What you get is what you get.
John Roach of Mithra.
All of these big industries in the northeast were taking on as many apprentices as they could get. Our school, Mortimer Road School, it was classed as a technical school, so it was a feeder school for industry. One guy out of the whole of my school went and did A-levels. Just one guy. So that was the funneling of the school process. We were funneled towards apprenticeships. We didn't have any resentment about that. That was just the way it was. One guy left school at 15, because he could still leave school at 15. So one of my year left school at 15, and one guy went and did A-levels and eventually went to university. We all went into industry to make money, to buy equipment, to become rock stars. Our parents had said, you must have a trade, because the trade was seen as a long-term security. Where are we now? There's no trades. There's no way hiring anybody with any of the trades that any of us have.
Tony Dolan, the demolition man.
When I was about to leave school, the shipyards were being sold off. Coal miners were having battles about coal and the union, so it was all total chaos. And by the time I came out of school, there was no industry in Wall's End, which was something like 200,000 people or whatever it was, worked in the shipyards, and all of a sudden they were out of work. course, you know, my whole family had been into shipbuilding. So it was just pre-Swan Hunters in Wall's End closing. And my father and my uncle were pushing me to go down there. But when I went down there, they were a bit reticent of giving jobs away. Obviously, the companies knew they were about to sell themselves off. So I struggled. And, you know, my hair was growing longer. I discovered Motorhead in 78. And now I was kind of trying to play an instrument. And I think my family just thought I was being lazy and I didn't want to get a proper job. But sometimes I'd go down to the shipyards at 5 o'clock in the morning and stand in a queue with a whole load of other guys waiting to be picked for a day's work. I think when I left school, I was encouraged to write letters for jobs. And I think I'd probably write 100 or so in a month. I'd get one reply and that was it. And that was a no. You know, I'd go down to the unemployment office and practically see everybody I knew from school, from the years below and the years above. So it was a totally screwed feeling.
Jed Wolfe of Tyson Dog and Atomcraft.
The local one, the bigger employers to me, was a place called Rerolls, where all my family went. My dad went there, and then my brother went there, and that's how we met the drummer from Venom. They both were apprentices together. And when I left school, I couldn't get in. I was the thick one. I couldn't get into Rerolls. But that's when 1982 was, that's when the employment was starting to hit, and they were coming to YTS schemes and all things like that. That's when it started getting bad. That's when the pit and everything was starting to shut down things. So I was just unlucky, otherwise I would end up at Rerolls as well, where all my family did.
Everybody knew if you were going to try and avoid a run-of-the-mill existence, there were only two ways to go. Football we took very, very seriously. We were the boys that played it from the moment that the sun came up until the moment the sun went down. Any time you were not at school, you were playing football until the last lamp on your back lane went out. The example had been set and told to us by our parents and our grandparents, talking about people like Bobby and Jackie Charlton winning the World Cup in 1966 and coming from Little Ashington, and their relative Jackie Milburn being a centre-forward knocking in the goals for Newcastle United. It was a way out. We honed our skills 24/7. From kicking around haversacks in a playground to making cloth balls called clouty balls and playing them in the house because if it hit an ornament, it was too soft to knock it off. If we were at the beach, a beach ball wouldn't be a beach ball anymore. It would be that cup final ball and we would play pretty much literally until we dropped. But the other way, if you couldn't master the skill well enough to be taken by a football club, the other route to take was music. People began picking up instruments and learning to play. From Raven, here's John Gallagher.
It seemed as the older we got, you could see going and getting your A-levels got you nowhere. I knew people that were a year or two ahead of me that were working rubbish jobs, even though they'd went to college. And it was like, I can't be bothered with this. Football or music, and we weren't good at football, so we kept on with the music. We went on holiday a few years earlier to Spain, and in the hotel they had a band playing, and the guy was playing electric guitar and behind his neck and with his teeth and loud and distorted and crazy, and we were like, yeah, I want to do that. So my brother got an acoustic guitar, a Spanish guitar, and we traded backwards and forwards and bother our parents until they bought us cheap electrics and then said, you're on your own from here on out. This is the money pit. We're not going there. It's all yours. So we'd go out and we'd wash cars and cut loans and do whatever to save up money to buy amplifiers and better guitars.
Metal might not have been the same if Atomcraft's Tony, Demolition Man Dolan, had not figured out what a bass was.
In the sort of mid-70s, my sister got an acoustic guitar for Christmas. I noticed that she never played it. And we'd went to Canada and the guitar had come with us. But by the point I kind of said, can I borrow this guitar? She said, yeah, sure. Because I'd been to Cobo Hall and seen Kiss. By accident, I didn't know Kiss, but there was a ticket. Someone's older brother said, why don't you come to the show too? So I went to Cobo Hall in Detroit and saw Kiss, I mean, you know, at their high point, like it was just the full stage show. And I went back and I thought, oh my God, I've got a guitar. I could kind of have a go at that. When I took the guitar, there was two strings on it. And I just tried to play it endlessly and had no idea what I was doing. Couldn't find any notes. They were totally out of tune. So I kind of gave up on it. And when we returned back to England, the guitar came with us. And then I went to see the Police and I was standing right in front of Sting. And I thought, he's only got four strings on his guitar. Well, there's only two strings on my sister's. Maybe I could work it out. So I worked out how to play Walking on the Moon and a couple of other riffs on one string and proudly showed everybody and then said, can I get another guitar? And of course, no was the answer. So I just went to every punk show I could go to. I went and then it became metal and I went to just every show I could see. And I was always trying to get near where the bassist was because I was fascinated with their fingers and how they were doing this sound. And then I saw Motorhead at the Newcastle University. I think it cost me £1.80 or something like that. Didn't know who they were, went to see a punk band and ended up watching Motorhead. And from the moment they came on to the moment they came off, I was shell-shocked. So I went home and I told my mum, I want to go up to Paul Garvey's or Windows. I need to get a guitar. Will you do a finance, HP finance for me? And she was like, okay. So I took her to every store and I wanted this bass guitar, but I didn't know it was a bass. I just said, I want this guitar. And the guys were going, what is it? I was trying to describe it. And then one guy went, I don't know what this guitar is, mate. And I said, well, I went to see a band last night. He went, where? I went, it was at the Newcastle University. He went, was it the headline band? I went, yeah. He went, Motorhead. I went, yeah, that's it. And he said, so the guitar or the bass? And I was like, which one's the bass? He went, with the four strings. I went, yes, the bass. He went, a Rickenbacker. I went, that's it, a Rickenbacker. And he went, yeah, I haven't got one. And I was like, oh. My mum went, right, that's it. We're going back home on the bus. And I was like, oh, there's one more shot. Please. So I begged her. She was not having it. But fortunately, it was just by the bus stops at the Eldon Square. So we walked up the top and he said, I've got one. But I don't have any straps and it's only got a couple of strings on it. I went, that's fine. And he put it in a box and I hugged it like a little baby child and I took it all the way home. And it took me 2 months before I realized I could put more strings on it or how to put more strings on it. And then I needed an amp and a lead and everything else. But the minute I had all of that, I sat down and learned every single thing I could off the first Motorhead album. And that was it. It's like I never looked back from there.
Fist's Harry Hill decided from an early age that rock and roll was going to be the way to go, giving up on what could have been a very different career path.
I wanted a trombone when I was at school. My mother came back from the music shop with a recorder because she couldn't afford a trombone, and I thought, this is a very small trombone, when I opened the box. I blew it a few times, looked at the finger placements, and decided it was pretty boring. Then I started hitting things with it, and I thought, oh, this is a bit more interesting. And that's when I decided I wanted to be a drummer. My father had died, and he had a beautiful piano. He was quite a competent piano player in the front room. In the days when nobody goes in the front room, people always live in the back room. He had this Bentley piano. So in my wisdom, at the ripe old age of about 12, I sold it for £45. It was probably worth a lot more, and bought a drum kit, which, strangely enough, also cost £45. And while my mother was out, I set the drum kit up where the piano had been, and I thought that she wouldn't actually notice. Unfortunately, she did notice the difference between a drum kit and a piano, and I got the hiding of my life. But that was my first drum kit. I had a very good education. I went to South Shields Grammar Technical School for Boys, where I was house captain and vice president of the school. And it was quite a good thing at the time. Passed me O-levels. Passed me A-levels, passed the university test in English somehow, passed for Oxford University. That was my school education. When asked by the careers teacher what I was going to study at Oxford, which was meant to be politics, philosophy and economics, I told him that I decided not to go and I wanted to be a drummer in a rock band. And that's exactly what happened. I'll not tell you what exactly he said to me, but it wasn't very positive at that particular point in time. Away I went to be a drummer in a rock band, and that was it.
I was always into guitar-driven music. It was T-Rex, you know, watching Mark Bolan with a Les Paul and the Flying V. That was incredible. And then years later, discovering the band who became one of my favourite bands of all time, and the lead singer bearing a striking resemblance to Mark Bolan, and maybe he's taken something from Les Paul Stanley from Kiss. But yeah, I mean, Slade, T-Rex, Sweet, sad to say Gary Glitter before everybody knew what was going on, 10cc. If there was a guy standing there with a guitar, I wanted to know about it. Getting into the heavier side of things, I suppose, came along when Alice Cooper came along, and that was totally outrageous. I remember that my mother wouldn't even allow me to buy the single Schools Out, but I went on a day trip with my auntie and she bought it for me in Woolworths in Whitley Bay. So I was the proud owner of Schools Out. And then it was just a progression from there, you know, looking for something heavier and heavier and heavier all the time.
And when Venom's Mantas, Jeff Dunn, could no longer find anything heavier, he decided he was going to make it himself. The young musicians of Tyneside, although they didn't really know it, had a common purpose, which was to try and escape a mundane, almost predetermined life by putting their energies directly into heavy metal. All they needed was a way to make their music more accessible to audiences.